This is the Oral Talmud, episode 15, To Svara Your Svara. Welcome to the Oral Talmud, a co-production of Judaism Unbound and Svara, a traditionally radical yeshiva. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm B'nai Laffy.
The Oral Talmud is our weekly deep dive study partnership in which we try to figure out how voices from the Talmud, voices from 1500 to 2000 years ago, can help us think in new ways about Judaism today. This week, we explore the story of one particular early Talmudic rabbi, Rabbi Meir, who we began learning about in episode 13. When we met him, he was a master of rabbinic acrobatics, able to flip any law and offer his incredible logic as support. Now, we're going back a page to learn about his origins, who his teachers were, and along the way, we'll go deep on a term that serves as a central frame for the Oral Talmud, Svara. Each episode of the Oral Talmud has a source sheet linked in the show notes on a website called Sefaria, where you can find pretty much any Jewish text in the original and in translation. If you like, you can follow along with the texts we discuss and share them with your study partners, or just listen to our conversation. And now, the Oral Talmud.
I want to just let you know about some exciting things that are coming up before we jump in, which is for the next 3 weeks after this, we have three very important and exciting and prominent Talmud professors coming up each week. We have Daniel Boyarin next week, and then Professor Shai Secunda the next week, who writes about the Persian context of the Talmud. So that's going to be really interesting. And then Professor Muli Vitas from Princeton, who has a fascinating story of how he came to Talmud, as well as a fascinating take on the Talmud. So I should also note that those are three men in a row. That is not how it's going to be. But right now we're in Corona world and we're dealing with people's schedules. When we can get them, we're getting them. And we have a lot of other folks coming up that are equally exciting and not men.
You know, when we talk about having Talmud professors, I have to say that sounds boring. But it's not at all boring. And what I think people don't generally realize and we don't think about a lot is that the understanding of the Talmud as its radical self has been living in the academy. It's been living in critical Talmud scholarship, which has been in universities, graduate schools, and it hasn't done a good job of seeping out from there. And it's not that the professors like have a boring take on Talmud. The boring take on Talmud, unfortunately, has gone into most yeshivot, not Svara, but other yeshivot. That's where Talmud is boring. Talmud's actually really exciting and radical in academics. And I feel very grateful to have learned from academics who, particularly David Kramer and others, who were in the academy and in rabbinical schools, and to have brought that take to Svara. So when we talk about professors of Talmud, people should know that those are the exciting Talmud folks.
Yeah, and I'm grateful for you for saying that, because I also wasn't even sure the right... I was thinking something very similar the other day. It's also true of Bible. You know, it's also true that a lot of... There's a lot of exciting things in biblical scholarship in the academy that most people don't know, because they don't study that in Hebrew school. And they don't study it in Hebrew school, I think, because the religious purveyors of Hebrew school, you know, I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I just mean like it tends to come from religious institutions of various denominations. Like they don't exactly know what to do with a critical approach. I actually am looking forward to, and these are projects that you and I are working on in various ways, creating that the third way that's going to be some hybrid of the critical, open, it's not just critical, you know, but open kind of thinking, you know, looking at every angle. It's kind of like, I don't know, I mean, I'm trying to think about like the night before Passover when you get all the, you know, you're around with your feather finding all the crumbs, you know, and or something like that, where you're just like willing to look anywhere version, which is lives in the academy, like you're talking about. But then the engagement study kind of for don't say like the love. I mean, you talk about love, you know, but the idea that, hey, this actually could be part of my life in a serious way that comes kind of from the yeshiva world of studying the texts from a kind of what we might call a religious point of view. And how could we hybridize that? And I think that's what we're trying to do on this show. So that's part of why I think what we're trying to do, I'm thinking about it as like, you know, like when you like fold over like a batter, you know, and you like mix in the new. So we're bringing these professors in and then we're like mixing them into our evolving take on the text from a non-academic point of view, something like that. And we're really grateful and excited that some of the most prominent and exciting professors that are out there are really, they're excited when we tell them about this show and that we want them to join. And obviously we had, it's not only professors, and we had Ruth Calderon last week, who was amazing. I should note that my dad, who watches this show, hey, Dad, he suggested that we bring Ruth Calderon on as a third permanent co-host. And I was like, yeah, if only.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, but I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, I was like, I think she has a lot to do, as do we. No, but so anyway, so that's what's coming up in the weeks ahead. And we're really excited.
And I'll add that we have a bunch, not only a bunch of women coming on, but a bunch of queer and trans Talmudist. So I'm really excited about that.
Yep. We have got lots and lots of great people. But we're also good people. So let's jump into to one of these explorations of the text where we're just studying a text together. And I guess, you know, I would just say about this that we're trying to do a bunch of things here, including role modeling in some way, a way to just kind of read these texts in a searching way. And I think with Ruth Calderon last week, it was an amazing experience of doing that, right? A text that neither you nor I had too much familiarity with in the past. And what she brought out of it was astonishing. You know, I think you talked to me about how David Kramer, when you were a student, you kind of, you know, he has this more radical take. And you said, well, is that just like there's a few selected stories where you can see that? And he's like, no, literally every page.
Yes.
And that was an experience of that. Continuing from our last time that we were doing this together, we've been looking at a bunch of texts that in some fashion talk about the ideal way that the rabbis imagine one should think. And that can manifest in how you are a good judge on a court, how you're a good student in a Talmud, or in a, I wasn't a Talmud in the time of the Talmud. You know, that's one of the interesting things that Richard Elliot Friedman says. He says, one of the really most important things to understand about the biblical times is that there was no Bible, you know. In the Talmudic times, as we call them, there was no Talmud, you know, but the way that people were imagined to be a good student, a good studier, a good creator of this, and ultimately like the kind of person that the Talmud really holds up as the kind of person that we hope people will become. And that's what we're looking at, various texts of that nature. Want to give another word of framing?
Well, I would just say that the Talmud is kind of the most sophisticated repository of, and the learning of Talmud, the most sophisticated Jewish technology for becoming the kind of person that the entire Jewish enterprise exists to create. And it was really Yitz who took all of the trivia that I had gathered in my years of rabbinical school. And sadly, rabbinic education can become just a learning of lots and lots of stuff. And then rabbis who come out of rabbinical school transmit that as stuff without a coherent understanding of what its purpose is. And it was really Yitz who, for the first time after I graduated rabbinical school...
We should just note that Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, the founder of Klal and an important Jewish thinker and theologian.
Thank you. It was Yitz who really brought to my consciousness for the first time the idea that everything, all of the technologies, the rituals, the prayers, the holidays, the traditions, the customs, everything is really in service of one thing. Oh my gosh, who would have thought? One thing, and that is the creation of a certain kind of human being. And that human being will naturally create this kind of world. So it really isn't that the whole tradition is about fixing the world. The whole tradition is about fixing the person. And that person will naturally fix the world and do a whole bunch of other things. But it's really about creating a certain kind of person. And I would call that person a queer person in the broadest sense. But we can put a sticky on that and come back to it another time.
Yeah, and by the way, like I think I would call that person, I mean, I would also call that person a queer person, but in other times, I've called that person an adult.
Yes.
I
love it. You're a mature adult.
Yeah. Mature adult. You know, that there have been times, and I'm trying to remember, I mean, this is now back, I think when I was working with college students, and people would say, like, well, what should they believe about Judaism, or what should they, you know, do to be a good Jew? And I said, I think that if they were a mature adult, I would feel very confident sort of leaving Judaism in their hands. The concern is that they're not a mature adult. And I don't mean about college students here. I just mean about anybody, that there's some way in which I think a lot of the fear that people have about the future of Judaism boils down to some lack of faith in humanity and people, which, by the way, I really think is well placed, you know, like meaning like I think you should be concerned about human beings. When I walk out my door and I see half the people in my neighborhood not wearing masks and et cetera, right, which is both, I think, a sign of poor thinking, but also a sign of kind of poor values, right, in the sense that it's, I've been saying about masking, that it's about other people, right? It's about protecting others. And it's not sort of saying that masks should be optional. It's like saying that drunk driving should be optional. It's not about you. And the fact that there are people out there who, you know, who are kind of going around, I'm like, well, I don't want to put Judaism in your protection, right? You know, I mean, but if a person was the kind of person that I was hoping a person would be, then I would say, yeah, turn it into whatever you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's jump in.
Okay.
So we are... The text for today, they're actually, it's an almost identical text that's in two different places in the Talmud, in the tractate Erevin, which is the same tractate that we've been studying and that we have another text coming up from there. So in a certain sense, we're still in this particular part of the Talmud that seems to really be talking about this question. But there's also another version of the text in a different tractate called Sotah. And one of the reasons why we're highlighting that one is that the Rashi explanation is better in Sotah, right?
That's right. So this text is actually on the previous side of the page we learned last time we were learning. That is, when we learned about the story of Rabbi Meir and how amazing he was. God says there's no one in his generation like Rabbi Meir. That whole story is preceded immediately by the text we're going to learn today. And I always like to learn this one after learning about Rabbi Meir, because once you learn about how Rabbi Meir thought and forced his colleagues to think, and basically how he walked through the world as a human being, I always want to ask, well, how did he get that way? That's my question. And to read the text in this backward order doesn't give away kind of his educational path before you really have the question, wow, how did he get to be like that?
Right.
So that's why I want to save this text for after we know Rabbi Meir. And we're learning the identical text over in Sotah, just as you say, because the commentary is much richer there, the Rashi commentary.
Let's just remind people very briefly that basically Rabbi Meir, he's this genius guy. He's so brilliant that the law is never decided based on his opinion, because we can't figure out what his opinion is, because he can make the argument for anything. And we're never really sure which thing he actually believes. So we kind of can't go by his opinion. But everything he says is like so brilliant. And that's basically who he is.
Right. And his brilliance influences others around him to think more deeply. They become more enlightened because of his confounding pushing and destabilizing and forcing them to expand their thinking. And the law, which is a kind of accommodation to the need to have some smaller than big truth norm at any given moment, is enriched because of him. But the law is never said, as you say, according to him.
Right.
Okay.
I just want to actually start by reading it from Erevin, because one of the points that it starts with is related to this point that you were saying about Yitz Greenberg making clear to you in ways that you hadn't seen before how things are tied together. And for me, I had a similar experience when I was translating the book The Orchard by Yochi Brandes, that all of these little tiny stories that I had always read as individual stories and never even really remembered that it was the same rabbi that said this, that said that.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden you start to see the narratives stitched together and you say, oh, actually, now I get it, that the same rabbi said these two statements because he's got a certain character trait. And what I think is really interesting about the text in Erevin, the text, like you say, right before the one that we were studying, is that it's introduced by Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, who is the same character that we were just talking about with Ruth Calderon, who had that whole incident where, he not only was trying to you know, jump into heaven, paradise without dying. But also, right, the whole point that she was bringing out was that he's this person who wanted to sit with the people who were ill and wanted to, it took these chances. So I don't know if it's connected or not directly, but I thought it was interesting to note that it's that same character who introduces this idea.
Yeah.
So Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, anywhere that you find a statement introduced with the following quote, a certain disciple said before Rabbi Akiva in the name of Rabbi Ishmael. So a lot of times the Talmud has this kind of quote, like this person said in the name of this person who said it in the name of this person. You know, there's quotes upon quotes, a lot of citation of sources going on in the Talmud. So Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is saying a very particular way in which the source is cited. So when it says a student said to Rabbi Akiva, quoting Rabbi Ishmael, that refers to, it is none other than Rabbi Meir, who was the student of both Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva. And the Talmud, there's a part where we took it out, but the Talmud is basically saying, like, it's confused about what does it mean where it says it served both Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva. How could you sort of serve both of them? And the Talmud is saying, that's not a problem. I can explain it to you, how the same person could have served both professors, so to speak.
So I think it's interesting that to learn with the teacher is referred to as serving a teacher. I don't know what to do with it. I think it raises a much fuller relationship than we usually imagine when we think of teachers and students. It's deeper, it's fuller, it's richer. There's something more to it, but we can put a sticky on that. And before we jump into this next piece, I kind of want to set it up by saying, whenever you look at a Rashi, your question should always be, why is Rashi talking here? Why is Rashi piping up? What's Rashi's question? What's bothering Rashi?
So just to note, like, Rashi is a medieval commentator living sort of in France, but is it North Africa? I'm not sure. He speaks French. I mean, he's seen today, right? I mean, we understand him today to be the most prominent of the commentators on the entirety of the Bible and the Talmud. But I recently heard a lecture by Barry Windheimer, who we had on the show before, who was really talking about this particular school of Rashi and his descendants who kind of were doing a kind of an important piece of work. And when you think about the early medieval period, it's actually not that long after the Talmud was finished as a document. And so they're actually, you know, relatively speaking, close in time to the finishing of the Talmud as a document, and they're playing an important role of trying. And what I think Barry, if I'm remembering this correctly, what I think Barry kind of pointed out is that what their project was to bring coherence to the Talmud, sort of how you were talking about Yitz Greenberg, that trying to say it's actually all about one thing. So it's not necessarily that Rashi's saying it's all about one thing, but he's trying to say there's not parts, it's not a disjunctive document where things are, you know, if it's here and if it's 2,000 pages later and it's different, that's like a sign that the editor made a mistake. It's no, that we have to find some way to weave it all together and to show you how it's really all one big point.
Okay. And at the risk of getting a little trippy, you just reminded me of that experience, which I know I talk about often, that you helped me have, which was when I audited a law school class. And it was a torts class, and I purchased for the class the textbook. And of course, it's 3 inches thick, and it's got gold on the, I'm looking at it right now at the top of my bookshelf, gold on the binding, and it's got about 500 cases in it. And, you know, in the entire torts course, we cover maybe a dozen cases. And it's very obvious that all of the cases are there not to teach the specifics of, you know, the content of those cases, be it about tugboats or locomotives or whatever, but they're all there to do one single thing, which is to teach you how to think analytically, how to think like a lawyer, right? Mm-hmm. How to take complex situations. And I think that's really what the Talmud is doing as well. What our text today gets at is the question of, what do you need to know? What do you need to learn? How much do you need to know? What kind of stuff, what does your curriculum and your educational path need to do to you to be this kind of person that the tradition is trying to create?
But you were saying that when you read a Rashi, you need to remember, like, the question, right, okay, is, what's he trying to, what's bothering him, right?
When you read the answer to a question, you really don't understand the depth of that answer unless you understand what the question was.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand the depth of the text we're learning today, you have to ask, what's the question this text is coming to answer? Mm-hmm. Just as a Rashi comment is always the answer to some question, unless you figure out what his question was, you really can't understand the import of his answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a backwards way, I said what I wanted to say, which was the question that this text is the answer to is, what do you need to know? How much do you need to know? What kind of education do you need to be that Jewish human being mm-hmm. that the tradition is out to create that was embodied in Rabbi Meir?
Okay, so I'm jumping to the text in Sota now because that's where the Rashi commentary is. But it's the same. It's the same piece from Erevin, and so it really is coming after this question: like, well, what does it mean to say that Rabbi Meir served both Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva? We should note that Rabbi Ishmael is a character who's more conservative, you know, more straightforward in his interpretations, whereas Rabbi Akiva is known as a much more creative, out there kind of reader, right?
Right. And in fact, each of them becomes sort of the father of a way of reading Torah and the originator of a philosophy of our relationship to God and Torah. And Rabbi Ishmael's slogan is, the Torah speaks the language of human beings. You should understand it for what it looks like it's saying and nothing more, or really not much more than that. It does what every author is trying to do, which is communicate. And what you think it says is what it says and what it means and nothing more. Rabbi Akiva is the complete opposite of that. He's the symbol of the Torah has omnisignificance. The Torah can and does have an infinity of meanings, and it's our job to tease them out. And for my money, I think Rabbi Akiva believed that with a wink, meaning mm-hmm. I think he thought that was expedient, but I don't really believe that he actually believed that. He just knew that was the way to be able to innovate potentially infinitely, to keep the Torah as a sacred document while also expanding its meaning. Okay, so these are these two kind of opposite teachers. And it's unusual for a student to have two teachers. Generally, you'd be in one lineage.
You know, sometimes I make these comparisons to like American law, and I would say like it's analogous to something like saying that somebody served Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg. By the way, who are friends, right. And they both loved opera. I mean, Justice Scalia is dead, but, you know, it's saying, well, how could that be? Like, somebody was a clerk for Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia. Like, how could that be? Justice Scalia is a textualist, like Rabbi Ishmael. Justice Ginsburg is a, you know, how you described Rabbi Akiva, you know, like, maybe there's winking and whatever, but she's clearly not just saying that the text is the plain text. So the Talmud asks, like, what does it mean? How did he serve both? And the Talmud explains, initially he came before Rabbi Akiva to study, i.e. Justice Ginsburg. Initially he came before Rabbi Akiva to study, but he wasn't able to, quote, stand on his mind. And we talked about this last week, that people couldn't stand on Rabbi Meir's mind, meaning they just, version of like, they couldn't understand what he was talking about. Right.
Right, exactly. So it's really interesting that the text uses that same exact language that Rabbi Meir himself had that experience of, what?
Uh-huh.
When he went to learn with his first teacher, Rabbi Akiva. And I wanted to translate this very close to the original because I think it has the opacity that the original has. And I think that's helpful because we're not quite sure mm-hmm. what Rabbi Meir's experience was. I think it could be a number of things. It could be either he couldn't understand what Rabbi Akiva's intention was. He couldn't figure out what Rabbi Akiva's position on what the law should be was. Or he couldn't tolerate what was going on in Rabbi Akiva's academy. In other words, he couldn't stand, literally, he couldn't stand the sort of radical free-for-all and creativity beyond the text that was happening. and this kind of creation of newfangled, unprecedented, unjustified, no leg to stand on in the Torah kind of law. So I think it could be either one of those. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's reminding me that we said last time that you couldn't stand on his mind, which in Hebrew is la mod al da'ato. It really, that's literally is stand on his mind. And it's like, I can't stand because it's unstable. You know, it's slippery. It's not that I don't know what you're talking about. It's that I don't know if you finished talking, maybe is a better way to put it, right? Like I'm not sure you're done. It's very confusing. And actually making me think about the story that we studied a while ago with Moses, right? And kind of having a similar experience where he doesn't understand a word. And it's actually interesting to think about it in terms of like, we assume that the right interpretation of that text is that he couldn't understand a word of it because it was all kind of newfangled. And Moses couldn't understand a word of it because he was from like the old times. But here we're actually seeing a young guy, Rabbi Meir, having exactly the same experience, which is that I don't really understand what this guy's saying. It kind of makes me wonder if maybe the student in the story who raises his hand and says, where did you get this law? It's a Rabbi Akiva. And then he says it was from Moses at Sinai. Maybe that was Rabbi Meir.
Oh my God, that's blowing my mind. I love that. Wow.
But, you know, yeah, I think that's why, you know, I think that's a great explanation for why you really don't love translations, and I think you have to be really careful with them, or you have to be really humble about them, I would say, better, because I think sometimes it's just not realistic for somebody to read something without translation. But at the same time, it's almost like every translation should have a star next to it by implication that you know there's more to it than this. So if you run into something, I mean, I guess I would say this about any translation, if you run into something that seems like you have some questions about it, you might want to assume that maybe there's a problem with the translation. And that's also why it's good. Actually, I just started, I got the audiobook of Robert Alter's translation of the Bible. And it's really interesting that it starts with this question of why do we need another translation? And I think that he's probably going to go to a place saying my translation is the best, but I don't actually think that's the right answer. I think the answer is that we need multiple translations because that's kind of how you get a little bit closer to a sense of, you know, what the original's ambiguities are.
If you speak
the original language.
You know, it's far we say the revolution will not be translated. As you were talking, I just had this new idea. I think a title for a book that I'm going to write someday is If You Meet the Translation on the Road, Kill It. You know, playing off of If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, right? If you have this idea that this is it, this is right, you know you're wrong. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So he's freaking out. Rabbi Meir is freaking out. He's in Rabbi Akiva's Beit Midrash and he can't, quote unquote, stand it. He can't either figure out what's going on. He can't tolerate the instability. He just wants to know.
Right.
He wants some clarity. Okay.
Right. So what does he do? He basically switches schools and he goes over to Rabbi Ishmael's school. He says he then came before Rabbi Ishmael and gemared his gemara, which, you know, one could translate as learned his learning or something like that. But the, you know, you again have the Hebrew Aramaic, which is gemar gemara. That's what it is in Hebrew, gemar gemara. So you're saying he gemared his gemara, whatever that means exactly, something like learned his learning.
So I'd say let's scroll down a little to the Rashi on this.
Okay.
So Rashi helps us understand what does it mean to gemar your gemara? What does it mean to learn your learning? What was going on in Rabbi Ishmael's Beit Midrash? While it was learning, what does that mean? So Rashi says here, the simple, plain Mishnahs or the oral teachings. Let's remember that the Mishnah as a book doesn't yet exist, but the Mishnahs as oral teachings that were most, if not all of which were probably pretty well established already in some larger grouping than what was eventually called by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in 220, it is already kind of out there in the world. And it's unclear to me how distinct of a set of oral teachings existed then. But okay. So
that's also an issue that we're now dealing with three time periods at least, right? Because we're dealing with the time period in which this story purports to take place, which is in the early second century. We have the story, the time in which the Gemara is edited, which is sometime in the 6th, 7th century or so. And then we also have Rashi in the, I think, 12th century, who is...
11th century.
11th century, who is, right, from his perspective, this is a true story that actually happened in the 2nd century. So he, you know, so there's a constructed world in which maybe they were teaching these oral teachings. You know, it's hard to, we don't necessarily know what it was in the, you know, or if it was in the time of Rabbi Meir. There's what we probably know even more surely is in that later time, there was some notion of a distinction between the plain meanings of the Mishnahs versus this deeper level of commentary that ultimately became the Talmud.
Okay, so just for simplicity's sake, we'll call Mishnahs what we know as Mishnahs, which is the entirety of the Mishnah, each paragraph of which is called a Mishnah. So all the Mishnahs together compile this book called, or comprise this book called the Mishnah. This book is a really tiny book. Mm-hmm. I know I'm dating myself when I say picture a TV guide. I don't know, does anyone remember a TV guide? It was this sort of fat pamphlet that you'd get every week in the mail, and it would tell you what was on TV, okay? It's a really small book. Think of, I don't know, it's maybe a half an inch in thickness and 6 by 9 inches. It could fit in your back pocket, okay? The entirety of the Mishnah, if you took away all the commentaries, would fit in your back pocket. It's really small. So what does it mean to Gamar your Gemara? What did he do in Rabbi Yishmael's academy? He learned the simple, plain Mishnahs. Just as they are, as they were taught by his teacher and his teacher from his teacher. In other words, straight up simple laws. The Mishnah is a kind of proto code. It's very sort of recipe like. This is what you do. This is what the law is. It's very simple. There's very little back and forth or explanations. There's very few, if any, stories. So it's straight up simple learning. This is kind of learning.
Just the fact, ma'am.
Just the fact. This is learning your ABCs. This is learning the basics of the tradition. Okay? Nothing fancy. It's a memorization process. And you learn these Mishnahs by heart. You memorize them exactly as your teacher taught them to you and exactly as his teacher taught them to him and all the way back a handful of generations. So these are the basics. And that's what sort of passed as education in Rabbi Yishmael's academy. That's what you needed to know. That's what it meant to be knowledgeable, to be gemirna, to know your stuff. Okay, great. So that's what he did. And now the question is, was he happy? Was that good? Where did that get him? So right. Let's see, what did he do?
Okay, so we'll go back. And so he did that. And then afterward, he returned and came before Rabbi Akiva. And as you write, Svarat Svara, which one might, in a Rabbi Yishmael kind of surface level reading, he learned to reason. But whatever it is, it's being contrasted with the Gemara, his Gemara, you know. So if the Gemara, his Gemara is like some kind of memorization, then Svarat Svara is some kind of deeper something, right?
That's right. And you know what just jumped out at me really for the first time right now is that we never asked the question, I had never asked the question, well, why wasn't he happy after having Gemara, his Gemara with Rabbi Yishmael? Why didn't he stay there? Presumably, other students gemared their Gemara with Rabbi Yishmael and stayed in that academy. Or maybe this Rabbi Yishmael's academy was a kind of 3-month program. I'm not sure. But somehow he knew that his education wasn't finished. He knew that he needed more. Or maybe having gotten this glimpse of what happened in Rabbi Akiva's academy and holding on to that still, now that he's learned with Rabbi Yishmael, he realizes his learning is incomplete or inadequate. I'm not sure. But what he leaves, yeah. Rabbi, yeah, go ahead.
I think it's interesting to note that I don't think Rabbi Yishmael was intentionally offering a sort of like intro course, you know, meaning like, I think if you asked Rabbi Yishmael if his program was supposed to be something that you attended for 3 months in order to prepare to learn with Rabbi Akiva, I don't think Rabbi Ishmael would be too thrilled with that description.
For sure. Agreed. And I'm sure Rabbi Ishmael thought, this is all you need to know. This is what it means to be an educated person.
Yeah.
You're done now. Now go out and be a rabbi, be a teacher. This is all you need. And it doesn't sound all that different to me from what I think the, you know, without being disparaging of anyone or any institution in particular, I think there are institutions that have this philosophy that that to be learned, they sort of have a literacy orientation, to use John Levison's framing of orientations. It's like, if I know a bunch of stuff, I'm it. I've got all that I need. That's what it means to be educated, and now I'm ready to, I don't know what exactly.
Well, I think it's, I think this sort of analogy to sort of whether it's like Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia, like there's something to it in the sense that, like, you know, you could imagine a story, and there have been stories like this, where somebody clerks for Justice Scalia, and then they get really good at ferreting out dictionary definitions of words. And then usually the story goes, and then they went and worked for the Heritage Foundation, and then for the Bush administration, and now they're the Secretary of State, you know, whatever. If the story is told, you know, the person clerked for Justice Scalia, and then he went to clerk for Justice Ginsburg, and then he really got it, you know, and then he went off to become a professor, I think the conservative world would not like that story, and rightly so, you know, because they don't believe that their approach is like a way of getting your sea legs and then you can go off and do the real thing with the liberals. You know, they don't, that's not how they see it. And I think that's not how, you know, Rabbi Ishmael saw it. At the same time, I think that a lot of, let's say, progressives in law actually think that that's like a pretty good, you know, like they say, a lot of people will say, hey, you should go work for a law firm for a few years so that you can learn the mechanics of how to, you know, file briefs in a very comprehensive way, how to do the research really well, and then come work for the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department or something like that. Well, the law firm doesn't like to think that way. They think they're doing important work. You know, so I think that there's something in there that's like, it's also kind of a little offensive towards Rabbi Ishmael, right? You know, it's not taking seriously. Well, let me put it this way. I don't mean that it's offensive in the sense of like, how dare they? What I mean is that it feels like it's coming from a very particular agenda-driven perspective, where in the view of the narrator, of the editor of the Talmud, they're saying like that conservative guy, not impressed with his philosophy, but he had some good skills that he could teach. That's a negative view of that philosophy that I think in some ways it's like you've said, I think before, like your slip is showing, right? You know, that it's kind of giving you a hint as to what the editor really thinks.
Yeah. So maybe we'll put a sticky on the question of whether it seems like Rabbi Meir needed to go to Rabbi Ishmael's academy before he could go back and understand or hang with or tolerate or be able to stand Rabbi Akiva. But I know you and I talk all the time about how much you really need to know in order to be a player, to be creative. And, you know, I'll never forget you saying that to be literate isn't so much to be able to read, but to be able to write. Mm-hmm. And that's always stayed with me because it speaks to what I think the rabbis are really trying to help us do. Not so much to be passive receptacles of information or what the tradition was and hand that down, but to be creators of. And I think we're going to get at that when we see what Svara means and what Rabbi Meir was able to do with Rabbi Akiva.
I would say, like, without reference to the text, I tend to think it's different for different people. Like, there's some people who don't need that early, you know, and some people like don't have the patience for it. You know, like I don't feel like I have the patience for it. Like even if, I mean, it's complex. There are ways in which I do, and I do it kind of on my own time and I read a lot. But I mean, like to sit in a class, like it's very difficult for me. But there are other people who couldn't do the really creative thinking if they don't have that under their belt. And so it's different for different people. But I would say also that the, you know, quote slip is showing maybe of the editor in the sense that I think that the editor believes, like, not only is the editor, I think, saying that ultimately the kind of person that we want is the super creative person like Rabbi Akiva or who Rabbi Meir becomes, but that we want that super creative person you know, who learns a lot of information before they do that, because we should note that, right, Rabbi Akiva, even though he comes from a kind of non-Jewish background and in a certain way is free from the nostalgia and the kind of things that maybe make some of the other rabbis unable to be super creative with Judaism, nevertheless, he is Rabbi Eliezer's main student for a long time. And Rabbi Eliezer is kind of like a proto version of Rabbi Ishmael in the sense that he's a guy who basically like knows a lot of stuff and is not known for his creativity. He's known for his knowledge.
That's fascinating. So you're saying, I never thought about how Rabbi Akiva himself got to be Rabbi Akiva. He himself got to be Rabbi Akiva because he had a teacher like Rabbi Eliezer first. Right. I love that.
Okay, so let's jump in. Let's look at the definition of Svara from Rashi, right? That's where we want to go next.
Okay. Right. Okay, so what was it that Rabbi Meir was finally able to do when he went back to Rabbi Akiva's academy? He was able to Svar his Svara. He Svarad his Svara. Okay, what does that mean? And let's remember that this uses the word Svara, which is the name of my yeshiva, as an not only the noun, but the verb. He svarad his svara. He put into practice his svara, okay? So what does that mean? Here we go. To svar your svara means to stand on the essence of the reasons for the Mishnah. Okay, so just stopping there, let's contrast this with what it meant to gemar your gemara. To gemar your gemara meant to learn your Mishnahs, straight up. And now, to svar your svara means to somehow get at not just the reasons for the Mishnah, which is one layer deeper than just knowing what they are, but you not only know the reasons, plural, for each Mishnah, you know the essence of the reasons. That's a layer underneath that still. So this is a whole different relationship to the tradition. You're now asking deeper questions. It's not enough to know. I think the implication is you have to understand the reasons behind something and then the essence behind that. Then Rashi fleshes it out further. On account of what is this thing impure and this thing pure? So it's not enough to know just the surface Mishnah level, what's pure, what's impure. But why does this thing have this status and this thing have this status? And you have to ask yourself, why do you need to know why? I think that's important. And I think the implication is it's only when you know why, or you know the essence behind the whys, that you're able to then create. You're able to then be free of the momentary form of a practice, which is trying to achieve a certain goal, and create other forms that achieve that same goal.
It's interesting because I just was thinking about, like, in a way that the negative side from a certain point of view of the why, it's like a lot of times with my kids, right? As soon as I tell them why I'm saying something, it's very dangerous because then they can try to lobby you that, like, you know, your rule doesn't flow from your why. So it's actually a lot safer to just say, because I said so.
Absolutely. And you're naming the millennia old dispute in the Jewish community that has a name. It is the dispute called Ta'amei HaMitzvot, the reasons behind the mitzvahs. And there are two camps throughout the Jewish tradition. One says you do the mitzvahs and you don't ask why, and you don't learn why. You don't delve into the whys. And the other says, no, of course you need to know the whys. And Maimonides is famous for being the proponent. Of course you have to know the reasons why, precisely for what your kids have in mind, so that they can challenge the actual behavior they're being commanded to do and say, but that behavior is not getting me at the why. Mm-hmm. This other behavior would. And, you know, that opens this giant door to questioning, undermining, changing, reimagining what the tradition looks like. And to lots of people, that's really scary. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So getting back to what does it mean to have this, I would say, more sophisticated, more creative approach to the tradition? Okay. On account of what is this thing pure and this thing impure? Why is, on account of what is this forbidden and this permitted? So it's not enough. To gemara means you learn what's permitted and what's forbidden. Done. That's all you need to know. To savar your svara, what Rabbi Akiva is out to do is to help his students understand why is this thing forbidden and this thing permitted? And upon what is each thing supported, right? What are the foundations? What are our sources? Why did we go there? Or on which verse? So this thing with support and verses, the Mishnah is famously and notoriously what's called unjustified, meaning it doesn't give rationales, support, justifications by tying claims of what the law should be or what our behavior should be to the Torah or to any other sources, Svara being one of them. But what's happening in Rabbi Akiva's Academy is kind of educating folks in the ability to make the case for a practice, both current practices and, I think, by extension, new practices. Okay. And this is what was called Talmud in the days of the Tanaim, which is, I don't know, it's sort of a beautiful sentence to me, and it feels very un-Rashi-like. It kind of goes beyond simply explaining the meaning of something, and it draws a bigger picture. But he's saying, when the rabbis talk about Talmud, like learning, this is what real learning was. Mm-hmm. And by the way, let's not confuse Talmud with the Talmud, because, of course, in their day, not only did the Mishnah not live as a kind of fixed, edited document, but Talmud for sure didn't exist as a document. But this is Talmud as in real learning.
By the way, I wonder if that's like a little bit of a lament from Rashi, you know, where he says, in the old days, that's what they called Talmud. Now that they call Talmud is this thing where people are just like sitting around memorizing again. You know?
Oh, I love that. I love that. That's fabulous.
By the way, like that's, I think, connected to what how you have called Svara, Svara, right? Because you're saying, look, in the old days, let me tell you what Svara really meant. But in our time, Svara has come to mean just like logic. And you're bringing back the idea of Svara meaning this, you know, in a similar way to, I wonder if Rashi is like trying to say, I want to bring back the old meaning of Talmud, which is, you know, really this searching exploration and not the current meaning of Talmud, which is like reading this stuff and not in a deep way.
Wow, that's great. And piggybacking on what you're saying, maybe Rashi is trying to say, that's what the Talmud actually is trying to still get you to be like and think like. And I guess what you're saying is already in Rashi's time, Talmud was seen as a kind of normative document, as another code. I love that. Okay, I'm looking at the timer. I want to get to the end of this. Okay, and to understand a thing from within a thing. On its surface, I think it's saying to be able to take what you have and to create something that you don't have. But it's a reference to a phrase that our hero, Rava, who's a later rabbi to this text, but earlier to Rashi, he's a late 4th century rabbi, who is really the expander of the concept of Svara. And over in Tractate Shabbat, which you probably learned not too long ago because you're doing Daf Yomi, right? And 31a, he asks the question, what are the questions that you're going to be asked when you die and go to heaven? What's God going to say to you?
Sadly, that was like 2 months ago, but yeah.
We're
still on the same book.
So one of
I know the first one was, how's business?
That's right, exactly.
Which was, a comedian said that, but it's, how did you conduct yourself in your business affairs?
That's right. We should do that text
sometime.
But in any case, one of the six questions that God is going to ask you, according to Rava over there in Tractate Shabbat, is, did you understand a thing from within a thing? And I'm not completely sure what it means, but I think it's really interesting that it's not just the scholars who learned in the Beit Midrash who learn how to do this. It's every single human being who is seen as having that goal and expectation. So what, I don't know, what do you think is going on?
Is that davar mitoch davar? Is that how it?
Lahavin, hevanta davar mitoch davar.
Davar mitoch davar. I mean, so literally it's a thing within a thing from within a thing. I wonder, you know, to me, the ring of that for me is like, did you look deeper?
Yeah.
Was it your orientation in life to look deeper or to just accept things at face value and look deeper as the aspiration?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a piece of it. Did you look beyond the obvious or the apparent and realize there's something not only other, but different than what appears on the surface, something like that.
I mean, yeah. You know, what I hear that also, and I think we could spend an hour on it, maybe we should when we get there, because as you even just start to talk about it, I think about it as like, it's about creativity. It's like, did you just accept the world as you received it? Or did you say, no, that's not how I'm supposed to be towards the world. I'm supposed to dig into something and find something else in it. That's just an orientation. It's not always there. It doesn't have to be that like nothing is ever the way it is on the surface. Some things are. But it was that your orientation to say, no, that's not how a person should live in the world.
Okay, let's finish that, Rashi.
Yeah.
And we should note that this Rashi commentary on the story of Rabbi Meir's educational path is the richest source that I'm aware of in all of rabbinic literature on what it means to put your svara into practice. And what we know of svara, we have to deduce from how it's used in rabbinic innovation. And I think it's pretty apparent what you can deduce, but this is really the best definition of what it means to use your svara. Okay, not only best, but the only one that I know of. Okay, understand a thing from within a thing. When a new thing would be asked in the Beit Midrash, from where would they learn it out? And to which Mishnah would they analogize it? And by the way, I want to say that I've put in the periods and commas. There are no periods and commas in Rashi or anywhere in the Talmud. So I'm not completely sure I've got the connections between these little pieces right. You know, I'm not sure, for example, if I should have put, and this is what was called Talmud in the days of the Tanaim, colon. Because that completely changes the meaning, right? Is what's about to come, but there's a similarity. So anyway, there are these little pieces and I'm not sure how they're all connected. But here we have this illustration of new things will be asked. We're going to have to figure out new situations and have bigger questions than we used to have and new insights that we want to bring in. And we have to know how to Jewishly bring those things into the tradition. How am I going to justify or connect and use what I have to learn something completely new? What were you going to say?
I was just going to say that like the assumption to me and the implied assumption here is that it's not easy. And I think that like, for example, think about the famous, infamous statement in Leviticus about, you know, a man shouldn't lie with a man, the lyings of a woman. So if you say, oh, well, what's Judaism's approach towards homosexuality? You know, a certain way would be like, well, let's look it up. Let's see, where did Judaism ever talk about homosexuality? It's like, oh, unfortunately, it's just one time here. And it's a bad situation, guys. Sorry about this. You know, that would be like...
And that's the Gamar Gemara approach.
That's the Gamar Gemara. Yeah, you're some version of that. You know, it's like, because what Bowen says, like, when a new thing would be asked, the svara is from where would they learn it out? Which Mishnah would they analogize it? So it's like that one is one where you say, oh, what does the Talmud have to say about homosexuality? Well, it says, for example, that he who saves one life saves an entire world. And so if somebody, right, you know, and you say, well, if somebody is going to feel like this is their life, and if you wouldn't be allowed to do this, then it would be as if their life were to end. And so, of course, you should say that it's good to do, you know, right? I mean, you could, that's an example that came to my head. So maybe it's a bad one. But like, you know, the point is that you could look at a million different texts and the art, and by the way, this is true in law and in so many other areas, like the art of it is to make that connection with something that other people see as maybe not straightforwardly connected. And what you know from, you know, what we know is that when that's done well, people don't even notice that it's being done at all. And people, you know, I can't think off the top of my head right now but you know, when people make an analogy or a metaphor and it's a good one, it's just accepted. I mean, one that comes to mind is at the beginning of George Lakoff's book. George Lakoff is a linguist and he has a book called Metaphor, what's it called? It's a book on metaphor. And it starts out by giving an example of how we see the whole world through metaphors. And he talks about argument, that we have been taught to see argument through the metaphor of war. I defeated him in argument. I was all over him, you know, whatever the words are. And he said, imagine that we had been taught to look at argument in the metaphor of a dance. You know, I took a step forward and he took a step back. And then he took a step forward and I took a step back. And we, you know, we got across the room arguing. You know, it's a very different vision of what argument is, but actually a quite amazing one. And he says, like, if we had grown up with that metaphor of argument as dance, we would have all accepted it because it totally works. It's mm-hmm. just a random chance that we ended up with a different metaphor. And so, you know, I feel like here what we're saying, or what Rashi is saying, is that what a person with real svara understands is that is the case, that metaphors and analogies are not natural. They're not, it doesn't always have to be. It's that somebody's genius is what makes it. And that's what we want to cultivate, is the ability to see sort of beyond the surface, like we were saying earlier, but in all sorts of ways.
I think that's beautiful. And take a look back at the text. I excerpted a very brief definition of svara that David Weiss Halivni, just below this, he talks about svara as reasoning that allows you to create. And here, well, I'll just surface this idea of svara that Menachem Elon, Alav HaShalom, the late great scholar of Jewish law, writes. He says, svara itself is reasoning that penetrates into the essence of things. So you hear the resonance of Rashi here when Rashi talked about knowing the essence of the reasons for a law, right? So reasoning that penetrates into the essence of things and reflects a profound understanding of human nature. It involves an appreciation of the characteristics of human beings in their social relationships and a careful study of the real world and its manifestations. And what I think Menachem Elon is getting at here is your svara is some combination of your moral sensitivity to the suffering and the situation of people in the real world. And that is what drives you to then sava your svara in the way that we learned Rabbi Meir did in Rabbi Akiva's academy. First, you have to know that something needs fixing, something needs creating, something needs getting rid of, that the tradition as we have it is causing pain and suffering because I'm in contact with, conversation with people out in the world. You know, at this moment, so many of us white folk are realizing, sadly and with embarrassment, that we have very few relationships with Black folk, and because of the racism that has caused sort of systemic segregation and inequalities. And we need to understand one another better to be even motivated to make the kinds of changes in our society that we need to make. And only then can we savar asvara, can we then try to get at and underneath sort of systemic issues in our tradition, be it Jewish tradition or our world at large.
Yeah, I think this is a lot for us to sort of keep coming back to, and obviously it will be because svara is called svara. This is obviously a really important topic. What I'm sitting with as we conclude is this question of, what if you're new to this? What if you, and I know that this is what you do every day with svara, that it's not as simple as you come and you don't understand anything that people are talking about at this higher level svara kind of place. And so then you have to go for a while to study with Rabbi Ishmael or Rabbi Eliezer, and then you can come back. There's something a little, and I don't know if it's different people or maybe there's a way to spiral it. And maybe what we're discovering today, what you've been discovering and what we've discovered in different ways, is that there's a way to spiral it so that if we tell somebody, hey, I believe that you have within you the capacity to be a Rabbi Akiva or a Rabbi Meir. I know you might not see it in yourself right now because when you come and you see this, you're confused and it's too high level. But don't go away to study for a year with Rabbi Ishmael. Let us find a way to give you a little bit of a taste of information and then a little taste of svaraing it and then a little bit more and a little bit more. And actually, it's making me think about our show a little bit in that way. Like, is it possible to understand what we're trying to do? And I don't know if we're doing it well, but that we're trying to do is like go over these snippets of Talmud and try to both get out some of the detail and the understanding of it, but also every time trying to sort of push it into these more creative directions. And hopefully people are able to kind of ride along with that, even if they're very new to it. I guess at least that would be my aspiration.
Yeah, I think about that all the time, because at svara we really focus much more on teaching people to savar their svara and showing them how the rabbis did it and how it's done. And I feel like that's the first phase of our project. And that's like getting the new team on the field to do that. And then the next phase is, okay, what do we need to fix? And that's kind of the Gemara part. And I really haven't figured out whether we need to then take the people who have savard this far and, you know, give them the basics, or do we get them in the room with people who have been in, you know, the Rabbi Ishmael yeshivas and who have now jumped ship. And it's one of the reasons I'm really fascinated by the possibility of folks who have gone OTD and have off the derech, who have grown up really deeply steeped in the Gamar Gemara stuff, who have realized that that isn't their path, but who have a lot of the material and maybe in conversation together. I'm not sure.
In some ways, that's my story, but I'm also fascinated by the other story, which I tend to think of as the Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir story. Although when you read these texts, according to the Talmud, at least, it's not quite that. Right, as I'm imagining it, these people come without a strong Jewish background, right? And they're these greatest geniuses we ever had. According to the Talmud, though, they did spend some time having to do this basic study for a while, which doesn't fully fit with my vision and dream. My question, I guess, for us to consider and explore is maybe today it's different because at that time, people didn't have any other education. And so when you're talking about somebody coming to learn Judaism, we're really talking about somebody coming to learn, period, at least as far as like what we would call post-secondary studies. And now we're talking about people who are extremely educated, extremely smart, sophisticated, and hopefully very mature people who then come to Judaism and fall in love with it or take an interest in it. And I feel like somewhere the answer is, and I love the team idea that you brought up, the idea that, yeah, there are going to be some people who know a lot of Judaism because they grew up religious, but there's going to be a lot of people who maybe they don't know so much Judaism, but they really know a lot. And we want to affirm and respect that and say, no, we actually need you to bring that stuff in. So don't go and unlearn that by studying with Rabbi Ishmael for 2 years. You know, it's like, so somehow, somewhere in there is the something. And I think that's what we want to be teasing out.
Yeah, I love that.
So we'll keep teasing it out. And but for the next 3 weeks, we're gonna be looking at some really interesting perspectives, you know, bigger picture perspectives on different elements of the Talmud. And then after that, we're going to come back to what we think is the next text in this sequence, which we're excited to do. So we'll see you next week.
Fantastic. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Binay.
Thanks so much for being part of our Chavruta today. We hope you've enjoyed learning with us and with the Talmud. You can find links to the source sheets for all of our episodes in the show notes and on our website at oraltalmud.com. Your financial support helps keep the Oral Talmud going. You can find a link on our website to make a contribution. We'd also love to hear from you. Email us with any questions, comments, or thoughts at hello@oraltalmud.com. Please share your Oral Talmud with us. We're so excited to learn from you. The Oral Talmud is a joint project of Svara, a traditionally radical yeshiva, and Judaism Unbound, two organizations that are dedicated to making Jewish texts and ideas more accessible for everyone. We're especially grateful to Sepharia for an incredible platform that makes the Talmud available to everyone. It's free at sepharia.org. And we're grateful to Svaranik Ezra Furman for composing and performing the Oral Talmud's musical theme. The Oral Talmud is produced by Joey Taylor with help from Olivia Dvorah Tucker and with financial support from Lippman Kamfer Foundation for Living Torah. Thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been The Oral Talmud. See you next time.